We're taking a short break this week. We'll have fresh interviews with Australia's technology leaders soon.
Hello, and welcome to the IT News Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Hendry. This week, we're shaking things up to mark the launch of the 2021 State of IT Report, an in-depth look at how the states and territories are progressing on the path to digital government. As part of that, we've spent the past few weeks speaking to government CIOs from across Australia on how their digital efforts are faring. First up is Eva Ballin-Vanook, South Australian CIO and Executive Director of ICT and Digital Government. We spoke to her about the state's journey to date and what lies ahead. Please enjoy. Thanks for joining us on to discuss South Australia's digital government progress as part of the IT News State of IT Report. South Australia, and specifically your department, the Department of Premier and Cabinet, has been, I guess, quietly beavering away at all things IT, digital, cybersecurity for a number of years now. It was the first to introduce important digital products like the digital driver's license, for instance, and it's well renowned as a leading government when it comes to innovation. So I think maybe to kick off, I was wondering if how this sort of stood the state in a sort of a good stead when responding to the pandemic. Was it able to move faster as a result of this this history?
Oh, absolutely, Justin. And thank you very much for including me in this really important initiative. And I think the more transparency there is around how states are doing, because we can all learn from each other. I've been with this department, so leading ICT and digital government for around 3 years. And so my first part was kind of relatively normal world. And then the second half was our COVID new reality. And that first 18 months was me learning the business, but also getting to know my team and setting my team up for success. And so I feel really quite grateful that when March 2020 came around and then we were being asked to go into lockdown, my team was also being asked to deliver new ways to ensure that our public servants could work from home, but could do so in a way that was secure, that would allow them to keep collaborating and, really importantly, keep delivering services to our community. So there were some initiatives actually that we already had in train prior to COVID landing on our doorstep, and we effectively accelerated those. So I feel as though we had this unique opportunity during last year in 2020 to really accelerate a broad number of programs. And it was simply because I didn't have to do so much explaining. The urgent requirement to deliver new digital assets, to build on top of what we had before, to very quickly modernise so we had the scale and the capability that we needed, that was apparent. And so, you know, obviously following our governance requirements and so forth, we did manage to execute a number of things really quickly, one of them being the COVID Safe check-in app. I don't know if you want to talk about that now or later, but that was leveraging existing platforms and jumping on that and making something really valuable for the community.
Yeah, I'm happy for you to, take us through that, because obviously it was one of a number of apps that were produced at that time by state governments in response to the need. So, yeah, how did all that play out?
Yes, all the jurisdictions. I think we all just worked, oh my gosh, we've got to help our contact tracers. That's really where it stemmed from for South Australia. So as you mentioned, we were one of the first with a digital driver's license, and we already had several hundred thousand users registered on that app, and that really was our digital asset for the community. And so early November 2020, the transition committee, so effectively the senior executives in government making decisions around directions and keeping us safe, effectively asked my team to develop something within 3 weeks, which effectively would allow a check-in component for all businesses and venues so that contact tracers would actually know who was where. And if we cast our mind back, when you went into a store or a shop, you had to put your name and write down your name and number. And I didn't realise, but contact tracers saw a lot of evidence of Donald Duck and Donald Trump visiting everywhere in South Australia, which is not helpful for keeping us safe. So we leveraged the platform of the MySAGov app, and effectively we built a component, add-on component to that platform. What was really important, Justin, is while the full app required you to log in and to register as a user, we made it very deliberate that to use the check-in app, you did not have to log in at all. And so we've had over 1 million unique phone numbers using that app, because they don't have to log in. Literally point my phone at the QR code, and then it takes an image, that data is encrypted. It gets stored in a protected environment in SA government. That's then managed and protected. And then when there is an outbreak, we get a request from SA Health. Officials in DPC then find the data based on the date range and the venue that's given to the health officials, and then they use that for contact tracing efforts. The other important point, I think, about building trust in the community, Justin, was that we committed to deleting data after 28 days. Breaks the hearts of data analysts because they'd love to mine that data. But we have had over 300 million check-ins using the app and more than 280 million deletions of data to ensure we're keeping our word to the community.
And you've also set up quite stringent privacy controls as well, from what I've read. So that was obviously a big component. How else did COVID-19 affect, I guess, how fast the government was able to move? Did it delay any of the longer term initiatives that you were focusing on in order for you to focus on those short term needs?
That's a really good question, Justin. I'm really trying to search my mind. Was there anything big we delayed? Look, there were certainly some initiatives that had to go out on the back burner. But what I believe we did is we launched a strategy actually in December last year for whole of government ICT, cybersecurity and digital government. Now, we were developing that strategy throughout the pandemic. So I believe that when we were reacting quickly to put in, for example, new systems or support for our community, it was on the knowledge of we've actually got a longer term approach. And so we're actually reviewing, and we'll have a public review of our strategy 1 year in. And it's really pleasing. We actually haven't delayed. In fact, I would argue COVID's given us this wonderful opportunity to accelerate some things, precisely because I've had to do less explaining to senior executives in other roles about why we need to invest in things like uplifting our cybersecurity. You know, Australia has, the whole world has seen this immense surge in cyber attacks. Unfortunately, governments aren't immune. In fact, we're sometimes a target. So investing in our cybersecurity uplift has been really important, as well as focusing on what are those artifacts to our community that really help them be safe, but also give them better access to government services when we know that in-person just doesn't cut it anymore, not alone, not as a standalone.
There are a number of interesting things in the strategy, including the portal that you guys have been funded to build. Now, and I'll come back to that a little bit later on. But just prior to you releasing that strategy, one of the major initiatives last year was the following the arrival of COVID was the creation of the Digital Restart Fund last year's budget, and sort of to support better digital experiences for citizens and businesses. And a lot of funding in that was provided to specific projects, if I can say that, but there was around 20% that was, I guess, available. Can you unpack the fund for us, and how do agencies go about accessing that sort of 20% funding that remains?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, this fund, Justin, as you said, it was announced in the state budget last year, which I think was a little later than the normal due to COVID. And many of the initiatives that it did fund address some of the underlying platforms or applications in agencies that did need to be refreshed and upgraded so that we can deliver a better experience. What happened then since that date is DPC gained a new chief executive, Nick Reid, who joined us in February this year. He's also the head of the public sector, and he's got a very keen personal interest in making government easy to do business with. So as part of his arrival, he's actually reformed part of the governance arrangements for SA government. He's established a chief executive council, which kind of existed in a slightly different format, but he's also implemented three councils underpinning that. And one of them is the easy to do business with council. It's quite a mouthful, but that's what it's there to do. And so the remaining funds of the Digital Restart Fund are now being reviewed and allocated through that council of chief executives with that mindset of, well, if there's something, for example, if there are single issues that agencies have but are standalone, they're important to address. However, if there are some very common issues that our customers experience, then maybe that's a better investment, because if we fix a problem once, it can fix it across the board. Our chief executive also has established some new senior executive roles. There's a new executive director, customer experience, a gentleman called Mike Diakomakalis. He's my peer, and his role is really to establish a framework and to triage and then prioritise what are those customer pain points that people are experiencing dealing with SA government, and then working across all agencies to whole of government level to really triage and then identify where do we get our biggest impact and where's the quickest win to the consumer or to the citizen in terms of how government uses its funds. Not all of those will be technical in nature. Some are going to be in person, but there will be many digital elements. So, yeah, so the answer is the remainder of that fund is being managed and governed by that group of chief executives to forward, I guess, a whole of government approach to supporting our community.
New South Wales also has a digital restart fund. Was this the inspiration for SA's fund? And you know, are they similar in any way? I mean, I know the New South Wales one has a, they've introduced rules that sort of limit the amount you can take in one go without showing, I guess, the results of that funding before you can come back and ask for more. So are there things like that that are built into the fund?
Look, there are so many learnings we can take from all the jurisdictions, and I've had some really good conversations with my New South Wales counterparts, and let's just say there's several steps ahead in terms of some of their thinking. I think ours was maybe a little less sophisticated, but again, our volume of dollars was smaller. So, you know, really, then I think it's up to my chief executive how government wants to take that forward going into the future. But certainly we did take some learnings from Service New South Wales around some criteria. They were good criteria. I think there's certainly ways we could mature it going forward, which is why it's now being looked at by this Easy to Do Business With Council.
Are you using the fund, I guess, in a way to reform how the government goes about funding IT projects by sort of reducing the CapEx and mostly focusing on the OPEX side of things? And I guess, how else is SA progressing towards that new approach to IT funding?
Look, I think it's been a perennial question for some years now, the CapEx versus OPEX conversation. I would say there's some parts of government where it's very much CapEx is preferred. But, you know, those of us who work in a digital space, I don't buy a box anymore to host my digital services. I buy a space in a hyperscale cloud provider. So that is definitely OPEX. So I see part of my role, Justin, I do chair the CIO steering committee, but I do chair a group of chief CIOs, who really talk about these things, because it's also an agency by agency decision as well. So there's an opportunity to kind of convert capital budget into operating budget. That can be done certainly at an agency level. And we are kind of transitioning a number of services from on-prem infrastructure, if you like, into that OPEX funding model and adoption of cloud. We recently launched a new panel, the Managed Platform Services panel, to help agencies migrate into the cloud. So look, there's certainly a great awareness that we have to exit some of the on-premises environments. Some will probably always retain a little bit of, but it is probably a bit of a journey over time to explain that. And I think the Digital Restart Fund was kind of one of the catalysts, if you like, or a stepping stone to help us start to think differently about how we manage government's funding, particularly when it is then operating budget related.
And I was going to ask about that new panel. That's connected to the fact that you're moving away from the hosting services business, I think, is how it was referred to in the strategy. So that's quite connected then with the idea of moving away from those old ways of funding IT, or I guess boxes instead of you know, cloud and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. We've been very open in saying that I'm only talking for South Australian government, because obviously every government has its own strategy. But from South Australian government's perspective, we don't believe we've got the expertise or the R&D and the resources effectively to maintain a state-of-the-art data centre or data centre services. So we are looking to exit out our data centre business in the next few years. It's actually quite a monumental effort to exit. There's a lot to untangle. And that panel actually came out of the kind of the natural expiry of two other contracts. We had the DCSS distributed computing services support, and then also the hosting services panel. And they were kind of both set up, you know, 5-8 years ago. They've served their purpose really well. But we do still have some on-premises servers. So the MPS, effectively, we have around 16 or 17 suppliers that agencies can go to, ranging from state server management, so still managing our on-prem environment to make sure it's patched and maintained and kept really secure, all the way through to using and managing software as a service Either bespoke or in, you know, from third parties such as Salesforce or Dynamics. So really to support the full spectrum of agencies. And it's the panel also acknowledges that not all agencies have the in-house expertise to understand how to move from an on-premises world to a hosted cloud world, because you do have to think about managing your environment, your resources differently. You have to think about patching differently, the economics of it. You have to still be quite smart and clever about how you put up systems in the cloud, because sometimes if you don't do it the right way, it ends up costing you more than on-premises. So we know that those partners are helping us on that journey. And, you know, just to be really clear, I do have my own budget to manage whole of government services, but each agency has their own discretionary budget. And so a lot of it is at the agency level, and agencies are making their own decisions about how they're migrating and transitioning from on-prem into the cloud.
I'd like to move now to an audit that came out last year about legacy applications, which is always a fun topic for any government. It looked at the 18 biggest agencies, and it found that 3/4 of those applications were a decade old. And as a result, agencies are spending quite a bit on additional vendor support costs and that kinds of thing, which is, you know, a sizable amount. I think it was something like 19 million, which is sizable for any state government, let alone, you know, a smaller state like SA. So, how is the government working to reduce the number of applications across the public service and drive down the support costs? Are things like the government services platform that you're going to be working on over the next couple of years, are those important parts of this journey?
It's a big puzzle. I tell you, when I came to government, I did not appreciate the complexity of the interdependencies of all of these different systems and applications, but it is quite exciting. Yes, it is. It is unfortunate. We do have a number of legacy applications, and that's what the Auditor General's report did find. The important thing is that these are known, right? So it's not as though there's kind of an ignorance or a disregard for them. A lot of them is around planning. And I think the opportunity we have is really to leapfrog some of these systems, because they are of a certain age. And if you think about the new services available in a hyperscale cloud world, where we do have an opportunity to leapfrog and kind of move a couple of generations. And my team is working with individual agencies who are maybe smaller. They don't have the in-house resources to support them with that. We are also looking at underlying core platforms and systems across government. Some of them have been around for a while and they have served their purpose, but my team is focused on, well, actually, we do have to modernise and, as I said, take advantage of new technologies in our ability to do this. At the moment, and I have to say Service New South Wales is our poster child on this, where you go to one place and you get all of your transactions that you want with government. We've clearly got a long way to follow with that, but there are some excellent models there. The way that we're doing that is that there'll be a kind of a single front door, if you like, for individuals, but also for businesses. So we'll have a business aspect as well as for just people in the community. And then when I log in and say, for example, I want to sign up for a new occupational licence, I will log in the system. I will have a digital identity that confirms who I am, the equivalent of a 100-point check, because every agency has at the moment a slightly different one. So we'll standardise that and make it easier for the user. And then when I want to sign up for the occupational licence, well, obviously some of my data is in some older systems. And so what we've done is we've, if you like, decoupled the reliance between the systems. So we're using APIs to make sure that the services portal can connect into systems that hold the data, but equally as agencies upgrade and uplift their underlying systems and data sources, that we can continue to deliver better services to citizens. So if you like, we're kind of putting a really shiny front door. It's a beautiful front door and a beautiful facade, and hiding some of the legacy of government, if you like, and trying to make that a bit invisible. And then as we upgrade in the background, it should be an even better experience for the user. So the services portal, if you like, is putting a nice shiny front door to then give us time to then upgrade some of the underlying platforms and still focus on delivering a better user experience.
And how will that sit, I guess, alongside things like the MySA Gov platform that exists at the moment, the platform that holds the digital driver's license? Will they be entirely different, or how will they? What are the dependencies there?
Oh, look, highly connected. Probably important to note is actually that the driver's license credential itself is housed within a secure database inside SA Government's network. So it's not actually stored in the app. The app then connects when you sign in, it draws on the original data source and checks and verifies on the spot. So the great thing is that the app itself doesn't actually hold the data. Even the app then connects back into core government systems to ensure the security of that. So, yes, we're actually upgrading the MySAGov app in a way that makes it a lot more flexible for us to very quickly respond to community needs. That's really what we've learned through COVID. We've had a very excellent partner working with us on that, but we have we really need to make sure we've got a lot of flexibility to respond to what users need. And I don't know if you're going to come to the home quarantine app, but that's been a really critical component of our ability to deliver mobile first solutions through a mobile application platform that allows us to respond to community requirements.
Yeah, I'll come to the home quarantine app in a sec, but I think just before we move on from MySAGov, apart sure. from things like the driver's license, what other services are currently available through there? Is it the same as a traditional services platform in that sense, or is it, you know, is it really just house a couple of things like licensing?
Oh, look, at the moment, it's got a digital driver's license, got fishing license, got a proof of age in there. It's got a firearms license, a boating license. It's got a swag. It's really what we call a digital wallet. So that certainly won't go away, because there is a difference between having an app that's got my credentials or my certificates in it or my licenses in it, and a portal where I'm actually wanting to transact and undertake, you know, pay money or, you know, complete a transaction, that kind of thing. So the app still will be a standalone, even with all the great work we're doing on the services portal. That MySAGov app will continue to be a really important pillar in terms of our digital assets for the community.
And you mentioned digital identity as well. Are you still working with the feds on that? Is that kind of what you intend to leverage for this portal, this services portal that you're producing? Is that the ID you're going to use, or are you developing your own sort of identity provider to feed into that?
Yeah, look, so we've had an MOU with the federal government, with the Digital Transformation Agency, since December 2018. And that has been invaluable, because the feds have a lot more money than we do as Little South Australia. And so we are wanting to leverage all of their great insight and policies and thinking around digital identity. So we actually have built our own digital identity for South Australian government and a digital identity broker. So the Trusted Digital Identity Framework is incredibly important. So we subscribe to the standards, but what we are not done is we're not yet an accredited TDIF provider. That it's actually quite significant, the effort to do that. So Australia Post, with their DigiID, is now a certified TDIF digital identity provider, but we are TDIF aligned, so that we do have that pathway in the future. And so effectively at the moment in South Australia, the reason we've really focused on this is as a core element of the new digital platform, so it is a core element of the services portal, is that at the moment each agency kind of has their own username and password, and as an individual I've got to have 30 in my head, which of course I can't do. So effectively the single identity, which is again all opt-in, and I can consent, you know, to leave my information or not leave my information, we've actually established that now in the first run for the SA Health Exemptions Portal. So as you know, we do have South Australians who are not yet able to come back into the state. And so the exemptions portal allows people to sign in and register wanting to come back to South Australia, identify where they've been, how long they've been away, where they want to come home to, and any details about them to help SA Health make decisions. So that's really been our first user application of the digital identity service that we've developed. But we certainly anticipate that in the future you'll have one password and one username to remember. And, you know, clever things like in the future, if you move house, I don't know if you've ever moved house, but you have to update everyone individually that you've moved house. And so in the future, having by consent that if you want to, we could update your new home address into other systems, but only with your consent, because it may not be relevant for all. So, right. Yes, so that's. Yeah, that's how we've kind of implemented that.
And how does that digital identity service that you've produced, how does that differ to something like what you've used for the Home Quarantine SA app, which has its own sort of face scan element to it? Are those entirely separate, or is that something you've developed in-house as well, or is that an off-the-shelf product for that home quarantine app?
It's two separate things. So for the home quarantine app, you need your digital identity that I just spoke about. So part of people being part of the trial, because at the moment it is still a trial with the home quarantine app, part of the trial is that we can somehow verify that someone is in the location where they've been authorised, for example, by SA Police. And so there are two elements to that. One is that we actually do aliveness verification. So effectively it's like taking a scan of your face. You get prompted up to three times a day. It's time to check in. You have 15 minutes. So I have to take a selfie with my phone. It is using a third-party technology that creates a mathematical algorithm of my face. It proves it's me and not you, and proves I'm a real human and not a mask or a photo. And then it also does check that the person is within the geofence location of their land title that they were authorised to home quarantine in. So they're separate. You still need to check in using your digital identity into the app to get the home quarantine app and to use it. But that check-in to prove that you're still at your place of residence, that's a separate solution that we have implemented.
I thought I would quickly jump to cybersecurity because it was, or it appeared to be, quite a big winner in this this year's budget. $21 million set aside to improve resilience across the public service. And one of the initiatives on the drawing board is a cybersecurity operations centre. How will this improve cybersecurity at a whole of government level?
We're very pleased to be able to improve the maturity of South Australian government's cybersecurity posture. So there are a couple of important things that we will now be able to implement. And one is around a cybersecurity operations centre. So this is really the ability to triage and monitor all the activity we see on our government network. We do have in South Australia a single government network, which is quite different to some of our other jurisdictional colleagues. And so because of the vastness of that network, and tens of thousands of both people and devices, the monitoring of that and the triaging of that. So there were a couple of things that we did get. We got some new people. We got threat hunters and incident responders to assist us both on a proactive way of identifying whether there might be threats in our environment, and then secondly, to have people who can respond and support agencies when we do see something that needs to be addressed. We're also investing in a security information event management service, a SIEM. We're also working and collaborating with the federal government. There's a lot of work around cyber hygiene, things like vulnerability scanning and then general education awareness, because we can build the best systems, Justin, and protect them and secure them. But if people are going to fall prey to a phishing email, then we're still in a lot of trouble. So a lot of that is also awareness and education of our colleagues to just be a little bit critical. Like if you hover over a hyperlink that you got in an email, does the hyperlink reflect the link in the email, or is it something very strange? It's building a bit of that awareness. So it's resources, it's new systems, and it's education across the board.
And when we go to addressing some of the issues, there was another audit report earlier this year, I think, about vulnerability scanning wasn't quite up to standard. Will it go to some of those concerns that were raised?
Absolutely. So part of that is we'll be funding vulnerability scanning across the board for all agencies. I think what we've really learned is that there are some, large agencies have more budget. They are able to invest in these things. Smaller agencies miss out. And so the theory is that we fund it once and then everyone gets to benefit, including the smaller agencies who may not have their discretionary funds available. That goes equally for risk assessments, penetration, pen testing. We continue to work with agencies to support them to make sure that our systems and applications are as secure as possible.
And things like top four or essential aid resilience, is that, again, things that this funding will address, or is that for agencies to work out themselves, or is this all of government funding going to that as well?
Some of the work we will do definitely will address it. The top four essential aid, we've actually moved with our cybersecurity framework away. We had a previous model before, and this one that we've developed is much more standard agnostic. So it's really up to the agency to identify, is it NIST, is it ISO 27001, which is the standard that most applies to their agency and their agency's business. And then it's their responsibility to look at their security measures and their security practices to see how they meet that compliance. We have a very active forum of IT security advisors across government. We've also invested in 25 cybersecurity trainees across government. We know they probably might not stay with us at the end of their traineeship, but regardless, we get to train them up and have some extra people in our team who are enthusiastic and want to learn. And all of that, I think, just helps us to have more capacity. We know there's currently a 17,000 person shortage in the cyber industry in Australia. And so we're trying to be creative about how do we bolster and uplift our people in such a competitive environment.
Finally, I guess it would be remiss of me not to discuss the fact that SA is one of only two states and territories without dedicated privacy legislation. So, I mean, you do have something called a cabinet administrative instruction that sets out privacy principles that are binding like legislation. But, you know, is there anything on the horizon there? And is this instruction adequate for the 21st century?
Equally, an extremely good question. We know that there is a lot still to do in this space. And we know that we currently have obviously the Information Privacy Principles instruction, and that absolutely does define their requirements for agencies and the collection, the use, the management, the storage of personal information, how they respond to breaches, how they need to protect data. It is quite substantive. We also have a government privacy committee that can also works with independent authorities such as the Ombudsman or the Independent Commission Against Corruption. So we do have measures in place. I will say, though, even though we don't currently have dedicated privacy legislation, this has not prevented us from collaborating extremely closely with the Commonwealth or with other jurisdictions on some really important matters. So we know that still obviously there is work to be done, but we'd say right now it isn't preventing us from being able to effectively partner with the Commonwealth and other jurisdictions and support the community, but it is something that we are aware of.
That was Eva Ballin-Vanook, South Australian CIO and Executive Director of ICT and Digital Government. And that's the podcast for this week. We'll be back with an exciting new interview next week. Until then, you can catch all the latest headlines in Australian IT over at itnews.com.au. Oh, and make sure to keep an eye out for the State of IT report. It'll be dropping this week.